Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. According to the CDC, too many people don't know they have HIV, or human immunodeficiency virus infection. In the United States, it's estimated that about 1.1 million people are living with HIV infection, and almost 1 in 6 don't know they are infected. So getting tested is the first step to finding out if you have this infection. June 27th has been entitled National HIV Testing Day, the purpose of which is to remind the community to know their status, to get tested, and the importance of getting into treatment if you are positive, which we will be discussing today. My guests are Terry Bramble. She's a physician assistant with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and she's also the HIV Program Director. Davey Norris and Heather Davis are with us. They're from the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. Both Terry and Heather have been here before. Davey's a rookie, so welcome. Nice to have you all here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, let's jump right in, and I think what I'd like to do is to help our listeners the best understand why they may want to know their status, is let's talk a little bit about the infection. It's caused by a virus. So, Terry, can you lead us into some understanding of this infection?
Okay. HIV is a virus. It's called a retrovirus, and it is passed predominantly through sexual transmission, some through IV drug use, and not much through other avenues anymore. The virus attacks the immune system, thus the name human immunodeficiency virus. It particularly attacks the CD4 cells, which, as Dr. Wesley talked about last week, they're the conductor of the orchestra. So they organize the immune system to fight off invaders. And when HIV knocks that out, then the immune system is in disarray. And eventually, if untreated, develops, as the CD4 cells drop, you can develop AIDS, which is acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, and that's when the CD4 count drops under 200, or you have an opportunistic infection. And when your CD4 count gets really low, you're at risk of all kinds of infections that normally we can fight off.
So viruses have a tendency to infect cells. Different viruses infect different cells. And this guy is a bad guy in that it knocks out a critical keystone element in our immune system. Is that what I heard you say?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we then are somewhat naive in our ability to fight infections. And we start getting infections with things that normally don't bother us.
Correct.
So what are the symptoms of just getting human immunodeficiency virus infection?
Well, when someone first gets infected, we call that acute infection. And most people will actually have a flu-like illness. It can look like flu or mono, with fevers, muscle aches, sore throats, rash. A fever and a rash in an adult is a red flag. And that can last anywhere from about a week to 3 weeks, and then generally that resolves and there's no symptoms at all for many, 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 many years. On the average, it takes about 10 years before the immune system is compromised to the point where we call it AIDS. In the meantime, damage is being done, but it's just not evident.
So it makes it so the problem, as I see it as a clinician, is fever and rash, although I deal with kids, is not a very exciting story. We hear that almost daily, and we tell parents, you're fine, stay at home, everything's going to be okay, it's hand, foot, and mouth, it's chicken right. pox, da da da. But you said in an adult, it should be a red flag.
Yes.
So it's less common in adults.
Right. And the history is always important, you know. If providers get a good sexual history and substance abuse history from their patients, then that leads you towards suspicion.
Right. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is the illness alone is not enough. A good history, especially a history of some higher risk sex practices that might lead one to acquire that infection is really what triggers some concern.
Mm-hmm.
And as I also heard you say, as this infection progresses very, very indolently, very, very slowly, not much going on, and then some unusual kinds of symptoms finally start 10 years later or plus. What's the most common, let's say, presentation that you experience?
It may be thrush, which can happen at higher CD4 counts. It's unusual in an adult as well. Pneumonia is a fairly common one. Shingles in a youngish adult. Mm-hmm. Not in the elderly, but those are some of the more common things.
And I would like to, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, again, all of those are not uncommon in otherwise uninfected individuals that don't have HIV.
Right.
That are uninfected with HIV. So we certainly can have shingles. I had a daughter in college recently had shingles. Thrush could be from being on antibiotics recently.
Mm-hmm.
And pneumonias are pretty darn common.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it makes you suspicious depending on how they did or how maybe how difficult it is to treat. But again, maybe that sexual history, which is an important thing to be asking people about.
Yes.
All right. And so we have an Alaska AIDS Assistance Association.
Well, I think one of the key things that Terry mentioned was that you can be living with this disease for 10 years or longer, and because you have no symptoms, you have no idea you have HIV. And that's the whole reason and the importance behind getting testing, because you may not realize you have it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's vitally important that you get tested. And part of the reason we have this annual observance every year is to really encourage people to get tested. And it's now a CDC recommendation that everybody between the ages of 18 and 65, is it?
13 and 64.
13.
There's a lot of different recommendations. I think that's the Pediatric Association. Mm-hmm. But the CDC recommends everybody between the ages of 13 and 64,
13,
which I think 64 is a low cutoff,
should
be tested. And then last year, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force came out with a recommendation that everybody between the ages of 15 and 65. They just had to be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
That was a grade A recommendation, which means it's strongly recommended and Medicare will cover it. And that has insurance implications.
So if I'm listening out there and, again, I have four daughters, one of them just had shingles, and I'm saying, really? They have to be tested for HIV? 13, 14, 15? So the CDC is not out there making any money off this testing. It's what everybody's mind jumps to. Who's making money? They're trying to save money, actually. So explain this recommendation to people who are skeptical.
Well, what we found was that a number of people that were diagnosed with HIV and AIDS would not have been tested based on risk assessment. There was no identifiable risk. Either they weren't aware of it or it never was identified. And so the increased recommendations were to try and reach those people that didn't know they were at risk and get a baseline and get people into care as soon as possible. Besides the fact that people don't always share their risk behaviors with their providers.
Yes. Right. And approximately 75% of new HIV infections here in the U.S. each year are the result of someone who is unaware of their HIV status and spreads the virus to one of their sexual partners.
Right. So providers are not good at asking about the risk?
I think providers
need to
be better about asking about risk.
Absolutely.
and patients. Yeah. People in general are embarrassed to talk about their risk factors, and so they'll kind of do everything they can to avoid that topic.
Right.
So it comes from both ends.
Yeah. So as a result, the just asking people if they're at risk may not be well enough, good enough, and we're still having a significant number of people who are infected who don't know. How can men or women, what are the things that men and women need to know about their sexual partners that might help them know if they are at risk? Let me ask that way.
Well, they need to know their partner's sexual history, even if it was kind of a further in the past history. Is there a history of sex with sex workers or a lot of multiple or anonymous sex partners? And just in general, has there been a lot of unprotected sex in the past? And couples, you know, can kind of make this into a date and go get tested together. That's another big push in the field is couple testing. And I think that's a great way for to kind of break that stigma and to go out there and make it part of the relationship.
Along with other STD testing.
Yes.
Why do you say that?
Because STDs make it easier to transmit or acquire HIV. And in Alaska, we are rife with STDs. We're having a number of outbreaks at the time, mm-hmm. at this moment.
Yeah, specifically, we're seeing an uptick in HIV and infectious syphilis this year in 2014, and that's continuing on from the last couple of years, but increasing this year. We're up to over 23 or so new infections this year with HIV this year so far. And for all of 2013, it was that same number. So we've equaled out to the full year of 2013, and we're only halfway through 2014.
You know what I failed to do is I failed to give our listeners a phone number, some contact information. So let me take just a second to do that. You can reach us with questions and comments during the next hour at about 45 minutes. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. We do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our usual email address is line1, and you have to spell that out, LINEONE, line1@alaskapublic.org. So for the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be here and can answer your questions or concerns or comments about HIV, AIDS, treatment, and so forth. This is a good time to take advantage of these individuals that are with me if you have some questions or comments or are confused in some way. So anytime I hear about an increase like this, I'm always interested in why. Sometimes it's you think you know the reason, but when you investigate, you find out it's not really the reasons you think. What do we know about the increase in HIV, which surprises me, frankly? I did not know that. I should have. But why would we be seeing what may be a doubling in the number of cases this year?
Well, the disease investigation staff at the state has linked most of the new infections this year to men who have sex with men who are using phone applications and the internet to find sexual partners. And that's concerning because these men are not just gay men, but also bisexual men, and so that could be a bridge over into heterosexual contact as well to spread the virus. And it's concerning because of not because they're using these technologies to find sexual partners, but because they're doing it very unsafely. They're not using condoms. They're finding multiple anonymous sexual partners through this technology. So the message we want to get out there is just to urge everyone to use condoms, communicate with your partners, and get tested regularly if you have these risk factors.
I think the other thing that we hear from a lot of the younger population who don't remember when this epidemic started, they weren't even born, is they seem to think it's not really a big deal, that you can just get on a medication, it will take care of it, and they don't really need to worry about. So I think those who weren't exposed to the epidemic when it started just don't have that history and just see it really as another sexually transmitted disease that, you know, a pill will take care of.
Teresa, what's wrong with that thinking?
There is good medication to take care of it, but it comes at great expense, and it's lifelong medication and has side effects. There are just a lot more health issues to deal with HIV.
Mm-hmm. What's the cost?
Atripla, one of the one pill a day medications, costs around $32,400 a year. If they're on a three drug regimen, it's about $36,000 a year. Mm-hmm. There's also a salvage drug, T20, that's about $100,000 a year if somebody needs that. So it's not cheap medication.
And I heard you say for the rest of your life.
At this point, we have no end point for treatment. There's no cure, so we can manage the infection and keep the virus suppressed, but we can't get rid of it.
So it's not like other sexually transmitted diseases.
No, it is not.
In the sense that we can't cure it. And virtually all, except I'm thinking off the top of my head, herpes, we can't cure. We can control. Most other ones we can treat effectively and rather inexpensively.
Comparatively.
Certainly compared to this. So this is not one. The good news is this was essentially a death sentence for those who acquired the infection when it was first really beginning to be recognized, because we were only recognizing it at the end stage when individuals who were infected were already had acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. And it was first recognized because of young men in particular that were dying of very unusual infections that most people never saw.
And it's now considered a chronic disease. It's, in fact, recognized as a chronic disease.
Yeah. Like many cancers, I would quickly point out, it is becoming more controllable, and you can live a long and healthy life with HIV infection, but we can't cure it.
That is correct.
What else is important for listeners to know about this infection? I guess I'm jumping around in a little bit, but I'd like to come back to the syphilis outbreak, because I know that syphilis has been increased. Is there a closer connection to HIV and syphilis? Is it the internet again that seems to be being used to encourage multiple sex partners that seems to be the underlying risk factor there?
Very interestingly, I think it is similar risk factors using phone applications and the internet to find sexual partners. But the state is not seeing these cases as co-infections. So it's not the same people that have both HIV and syphilis. It's kind of a separate group, but linked to the same risk factor. So that's quite interesting, especially since, like Terry mentioned earlier, if you're diagnosed or if you're infected with another STD like chlamydia or gonorrhea or syphilis, you are like 2 to 5 times more likely to become infected with HIV if you're exposed.
I remind listeners again, since I failed to do it at the beginning, I want to give you our contact numbers if you have questions or comments. Our local number, 550-8433. It's 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And our email address is, and our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. There's also a recommendation now for pregnant women. I'm not sure when that started exactly. Somebody want to give me the rationale for that one?
I'm not exactly sure when it started, but it's been certainly as long as I've been doing this, 13 years, that all pregnant women should be tested for HIV. And because we can make a huge impact on the health of the baby, if a woman does not receive treatment while she's pregnant and delivers her baby, there's about a 1 in 4 chance that the baby will get HIV. If the woman is diagnosed and treated and this continues through her pregnancy and baby gets 6 weeks of meds after they're born, that risk is less than 2%, closer to 1%. And we have not seen, we've had 30 some pregnancies we've worked with, and we have not seen a single baby be born with HIV.
pregnant women are, I mean, it seems to me, inundated with messages about concerns of taking medication during pregnancy. Have you found that this is a barrier to treating pregnant women, and how much of a risk is it?
Generally, I wouldn't say it's a barrier because most women are really concerned about the health of the baby, so that benefit way outweighs the risk. It's usually recommended, if they're not already on medications, to wait till the second trimester, but if they're already on medications, to just continue them. And we're not aware of any, there's certain medications that you do try to avoid in pregnancy. We're not aware of a lot of risks, but there is a pregnancy registry for women who take antiretrovirals that tracks this, so that over time we'll be able to have that information.
So like a lot of what's being done in medicine is we're not only keeping track of what's happening while they're on it, we're kind of keeping a registry to see what happens to them and the children over time to see if there's been some effects that may be more subtle to see or may be longer in manifesting themselves.
Right. But we do know that babies born with HIV have much bigger problems than anything that might have come from the meds.
Right. And what you've just said is a point that I keep hammering at here is people always, not always, often are asking providers, what's the risk of treatment? And I think the real questions are, what's the risk of treatment versus the risk of not treating? Right. You have to balance both, and there is often a risk of not doing something as well as the risk of doing something. And I'm often quick to point out also, if that makes sense to you, then if there's no evidence, and almost everything has risk, you have a hard time telling me something doesn't have risk, even if it's just financial risk, but there's all kinds of risk. If something is not shown to be effective and everything's got risk, then why do something that has never been shown to be effective? So those are two reasonable arguments, I think, that people ought to keep in their mind when talking about treatments. Here's a question that comes in by email. If a couple has been together for a year or more in a monogamous relationship, but with prior partners, what might you say to convince them to be tested before they marry, or should they be tested? In the old days, I don't know when that was exactly, couples often had a premarital exam. Is there a value today in having one, and what might that include?
I think that, yes, definitely the couple should be tested. There is certainly a benefit to getting tested just in case that there is HIV or some other STD present. It can just save so much time and money and heartache in the future to know before you enter into the sexual relationship, whether that's marriage or just a long-term monogamous relationship. And, you know, I would say to that couple that we're all human and we all make mistakes, and something in the past may have happened, and you wanna check that out before you potentially impact someone else's life.
And again, it goes back to that maybe not knowing that you have this because there are no symptoms. And unless you know all the sexual histories of all your sexual partners, you have no way of knowing.
And trusting it.
And the IV.
And, one of the populations we haven't talked about is the injection drug using population.
I always like to talk about misconceptions. There may be people who are still worried about the exposure from blood transfusions and so forth. Is that a significant risk, reasonable risk?
It's anymore? A negligible risk in this day and age because of the screening of the blood products.
And again, there is no zero risk, it's not worth worrying about for the most, in all intents and purposes.
Correct.
All right. So let's take our usual break. We've gotten to close to halfway done already. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number for questions and comments, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be off the air for just a short break, and then we'll continue our discussion on HIV and AIDS with Terry Bramell of ANTHC, Davy Norris, and Heather Norris of the Alaskan AIDS Assistant, Heather Davis of the Alaskan AIDS Assistant Association. My apologies. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Terry Bramell. She is the HIV Program Director at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Also in the studio today are Davy Norris and Heather Davis of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. What we're doing is we're discussing what listeners should know, all listeners for the matter, about human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, and the illness that commonly results from this infection, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, or AIDS. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433, and you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. I always love to remind people that this program repeats tonight at 9 to 10, but it's a taped broadcast, so we will not be able to answer questions. But you can always go to our website at alaskapublic.org and look up the Line 1 link, and we have archives to all of our programs so they can be listened to at any time, or you can refer somebody that you think would benefit from listening to the program to that website, so you don't have to listen to it on the air. Where are we? Let's talk a little bit about the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. How long has that been in existence, and what's the purpose?
Well, the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association began in 1985, and it was actually a volunteer helpline service when no other agency in Alaska was addressing the illness. In 1986, the 4-A's became a nonprofit. It had a budget of about $25,000 to start. In 1988, there was a huge explosion in the growth of clients served and the services that we provided. Now we have a budget of over $1.7 million. We provide HIV case management services, prevention services. We're the statewide provider of the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. We actually have housing that we can provide to clients. We do HIV testing, hepatitis C testing, and those are rapid tests so people can get their results in 20 minutes. We run the syringe exchange for people here in Anchorage, and we're always there to provide referral assistance and up-to-date HIV AIDS information. And we also have a satellite office in Juneau, which provides the same services on a much smaller scale.
What about listeners who might want to get more information? And what I want to stress is reliable information. Obviously, now anybody can go online and pretend to know what they're talking about. And I need to be sure that when we give information on this program, we vet that as well as we can. So give me some good contact information for people who want to get more reliable information.
I think that the government websites are always reliable information and really easy to digest information. It's documented for a general audience. And so there's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's website at cdc.gov. There's the National Institutes of Health website at NIH.gov, and there's also AIDS.gov, which provides a really comprehensive timeline of HIV in the United States and also in some other parts of the world. So it's a really great resource to find kind of the history of the virus.
But your own organization.
Of course.
How do people get in touch with you?
You can call us at 907-253-2050. You can visit us in person at 1057 West Fireweed Lane, Suite 102, on the corner of Fireweed and Spinard, or you can go to our website at alaskanaids.org.
We also run an HIV/AIDS hotline, and that number is 1-800-478-2437.
And the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has an STD prevention program that has a wonderful website that was designed to target rural youth, particularly, called iknowmine.org. And also on that, there's a link to an home STD testing for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and trichomonas called iwantthekit.org. And they have a lot of educational information and links to services and that sort of thing. It's a great website.
It's a really well done website. Yeah.
While I want to chastise myself a little bit for not asking you to give the native contact information and so forth, I should ask, is there an educational, cultural, religious, any kind of biases that you can think of that may lead to less likelihood of being infected? Does this particular infection seem to cross all the lines, so to speak?
It crosses all socioeconomic borders, but it tends to more impact definitely men who have sex with men and minorities. Wherever you go, it tends to be heavier in the minority population. In the U.S., the South, and African Americans is by far disproportionately impacted.
Okay. I have a email that came in that's directed particularly to me and is wondering if, says, I wonder if Dr. Woodard would mind sharing his opinion as to why providers are so lousy at getting a good sexual history from their patients. What would help providers improve getting a good sexual history? Many patients, providers have patients both single and married and are sexually active, yet most providers don't engage into a discussion about this. And I think that is part of the reason why testing is being recommended, is that it's been shown, as we've commented already, that we often don't, including me. Sometimes I have a limited amount of time with patients, and I try to prioritize, and I may not prioritize right. I may be fooled by risk factors. I may feel uncomfortable because I can't separate teens from parents in the room, which makes it more difficult to begin to talk about the situation. But, you know, I would say overall, I think time with patients is one of the biggest problems that we face in this country. We really have not been good at incentivizing more communication between patients and providers. And I don't have much evidence to that. It's my own personal bias that I think that is a huge problem with not only this problem, but many of our healthcare problems, is that we really are not spending enough time to getting to know our patients and beginning to talk about things that may not be easy to talk about without first developing some rapport, which I don't know how to do very well without time, although we're being coached as providers to learn how to get better and better in shorter amounts of time to try to do it. So I hope that is a fairly good answer to a difficult question regarding why providers are not so good at doing it, at getting that history. Don, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Dr. Ted Woodward, I think you are right on point. I was missed the first couple minutes of your first second half here. And this was a point that I was bringing out. You touched on it, and that was some of the ramifications of people misusing or information or calling it what we used to refer to as disinformation trying to secure their own position, be it for status or spite or whatever. I know of some cases here that came through the court system some years ago back in the 80s and 90s where people were getting actually convicted. And some of the basis of it was supposedly they had given a certain person the disease, and this was allegedly the proof that was offered showing that this person was guilty of a crime. And as it turned out, the person finally got bailed out some years later when it came out, and the conclusion got thrown out because how could the person give somebody a disease that he didn't have? So despite the fact the jury had found him guilty, a overzealous prosecutor or counselor or whoever, I've really seen some atrocious things go down. I've seen doctors curse off some parents with their office door open and everybody out in the lobby could hear it. And it's very, very nasty, very unprofessional, among other things. And I've seen some parents or whoever, counselors, whatever, you know, just literally put kids into tears, accusing them of doing things that they didn't.
Right, right. And,
it's very unfair, especially if it's done under the badge of a supposedly unbiased government agency.
All right. Thanks for your call, Don.
Thank you.
Have a good day. What about, we've talked about testing, and I think there's probably some information we all should know about testing, and I'm talking about not only the tests that may be done in providers' offices so that we understand what they really are telling us, but also there's the over-the-counter test now, and we all need to understand what that's all about.
Well, the over-the-counter test, the home test that's available for purchase at Walgreens, and I know for sure Walgreens and I believe Walmart and some other pharmacies as well, is actually the same test that many, the same rapid antibody test that many providers, including 4A's, uses, and that's the OraQuick Advance rapid HIV 1 and 2 antibody test. And you mentioned, you know, everyone should know what these tests are and what they're actually looking for. So the rapid testing technology is primarily antibody tests. So an antibody is the cell that the immune system develops to in response to an infection. And it does take time for the immune system to recognize an infection and develop that antibody cell. So these tests are not looking for the actual virus. They're looking for the antibody cell. And so there is a window period associated with it. Typically, 3 months is the outer range of that window period for HIV, for the antibody tests.
So what you're saying is because of that window period, if someone goes out, has a sexual encounter, they regret and they worry, they go out the next day or two or a week and get this rapid test, and it is negative, that is not a good test to answer that question, could I be infected?
That's correct. A recent exposure that's less than at least 4 to 6 weeks old, and really if it's less than 3 months old, the antibody test may not be accurately detecting an infection that could be present and developing at that point.
And that's true of all antibody tests. And so a recommendation that I'm aware of, and Terry, tell me if I'm wrong, is at least try to wait 3 months. And I know a lot of times I'm, even then, I'm repeating it 3 to 6 months later.
Right. If I was concerned, I would actually get tested at a month and then follow up at 3 months.
Okay.
But there is new technology in HIV testing where it's a combination of the antibody and the antigen, which is a piece of the virus, and that is much more sensitive, and that's what the state lab is now using to screen. And then if that's positive, it goes on for confirmation. I'm not aware of anybody, there are rapid tests that use this technology, but I'm not aware of anybody using that in the state.
Yeah, there's a, it's, I think it's called a P24 antigen antibody combo test, but I'm not aware of anywhere in the state that's using it aside from the, the lab.
And that's called fourth generation HIV testing, and it could potentially cut the window period down to a couple of weeks, but it will pick it up sooner. And it also, there is one test that will actually differentiate whether it was the antibody or the antigen, which helps you stage it if it's acute infection, if one and not the other is positive.
Just to make it clear to people, antibodies is the immune response to the infection. The antigen is the, or the, some component of the infectious agent being measured. And so obviously the infectious agent may be easier and earlier to detect than an immune response. It may take some time, but there are, there's no 100%. Just like there's no risk situation, there's no 100% perfect test. And in particular, there can be false positive tests. We're learning about that, particularly with mammograms and prostate things we've been testing, we've been talking about. What's the worry about false positives with these tests?
Sometimes it can be a little bit hard to sort out, but generally where we see false positive tests, and that's in the screening test, is with women that have had a number of children in autoimmune disease and in different hepatitis infections because they have a similar protein to that antibody, but the confirmatory test would be negative. And there are people that just repeatedly have a positive screen and the confirmatory test is negative. So, you know, based on risk, they don't need to keep getting tested unless they do have some risk behaviors.
Let me remind listeners again how you can get in touch with us. We've got about 15 more minutes. If you've got questions that are weighing on your mind, you're hesitant about whether you should call, why don't you just go ahead and call and see if we can answer it. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. A question that came to my mind just briefly when we were talking about pregnant women is the issue about breastfeeding and breast milk as a way of transmission. I guess that comes to my mind particularly now because we're hearing about women that are sharing breast milk for various reasons, and there are breast milk banks that where the milk is actually looked at and tested about like a blood transfusion. I don't want to make too close of a connection, but very carefully vetted to be safe. What's the risk with breast milk, however, of transmitting HIV?
If a woman has HIV, the risk is about 12%, I believe, that she can transmit it to the baby. Of course, that's going to be less if they're undetectable. But in the U.S., we do not recommend that HIV-positive women breastfeed. In the rest of the world, in developing countries, that risk, the risk of trying to provide an alternative is much higher. And so they do breastfeed in places like Africa.
Okay. I have a question that was emailed in. It says, what are the risk factors for AIDS, or HIV infection and AIDS, let's say, I'll edit this question, and other STDs that lesbians have? I commonly hear my girlfriend say they have zero risk factors because they have never had sex with men.
Well, the risk is certainly lower among women who have sex with women only, but it's not zero. Certainly any adult or child, for that matter, that is sexually active is or uses injection drugs is at risk for contracting HIV. The risk is much, much lower among women who have sex with women. And that's, you can read that right on the CDC website.
Any other comments? certainly other STDs could be, and I was kind of distracted looking at something, so I hope you didn't say this, but they also ask about other STDs, and there's clearly STDs that can be transmitted from woman to woman, whereas HIV theoretically is a little bit more difficult, but certainly not zero.
Right. There are plenty of other STDs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, trichomosis. And these STDs can be transmitted and are often transmitted among women who have sex with women. And that can be through vaginal sex or oral sex or sharing a sex toy without cleaning it properly. There's plenty of ways these STDs are transmitted.
What about needle exposure? I think this is another area where there's been some advances that have been very helpful, and I don't know that everybody understands the success of those programs. So what am I referring to?
I believe you're referring to syringe exchange programs,
mm-hmm.
and there has been decades of research on syringe exchange programs. Communities that have syringe exchanges have lower rates of HIV. They have lower rates of hepatitis C. They actually have lower rates of drug use in general. Syringe exchanges, contrary to popular belief, do in fact lead people to get more educated about their drug use and does have a result of reducing drug use in that community. And so it's a great program. We run a syringe exchange at the 4A's here in Anchorage and one in Juneau as well.
What about the risk of a happily married couple, one of which who is infected and being treated for HIV? What's their risk of transmission, and what has that helped us understand about what I'm going to call pre-exposure prophylaxis or treatment?
There's a couple different issues there. In a what we call a serodiscordant couple, where one is positive and one is negative, if the positive partner is treated for HIV and maintains an undetectable viral load, which means it's so low that we're not measuring it, the risk is extremely small of transmitting. It's never zero, as you said, but it's extremely small. There have been some studies, international studies, looking at this, and so we have really good data on it. We still advise protected sex, but it's pretty safe. And then in terms of pre-exposure prophylaxis, there have been studies as well where a negative partner of a HIV-positive person can take a pill that helps protect them from getting infected. The issues with that are, the main finding they found in these big studies was you had to take the pill for it to work. And adherence was very poor in some groups. And it's certainly not something you do for life. It's something you do for a period of time when maybe your behaviors are higher risk. And if it's a couple, I'd say the money is better spent getting the positive person well treated. But we've had cases where the positive person refuses treatment and they continue having exposure, and so the best choice is to put the negative person on this pre-exposure prophylaxis. Costs money, it requires monitoring. It's not, any med is not without risk. But it is effective if used, and it is another tool for prevention that can be very effective.
Yeah, and this pill that Terry's referring to is Truvada, and it is the PrEP pill, and it is an HIV medication, and with any other HIV medication, if there's not adherence to it, there can be drug resistance developed, and that can lead to big problems later on if the HIV negative partner does become infected at some point.
What can individuals who are listening to the program do if they want to be tested but want to have confidential testing? What are their options here in Anchorage and then in Alaska as well?
Well, we do confidential HIV testing at 4A's. There's also confidential HIV testing at the Municipality Reproductive Health Clinic and over at ANTHC as well. And of course, there's the home test that one can get and be completely anonymous. And I'd like to stress the difference between confidential and anonymous because I think those two terms get confused a lot. The testing that is provided is confidential, but it's not anonymous. So that means name and other identifying information is required to be provided in order for us to, at least at the 4A's, I know, in order for us to be able to administer the test. And that's because of our federal law requirements and funding requirements also for the people that fund our testing. But we don't share that information unless there's a positive result, and that's only shared with the need to know folks at the state.
What about the idea of protected sex that was mentioned here? What, when we talk about HIV in particular, what has been shown to be fairly effective at preventing transmission?
Well, certainly protected sex, correct and consistent condom use is what I'm referring to, is highly effective in preventing HIV and other STDs. Like we've said many times on this program so far, it's not 100% effective. Condoms can break, especially if proper lubrication is not used. Contents of the condom can leak or spill over the top. So it's not 100% effective, but for a sexually active individual, it is one of your best tools in your toolbox to prevent HIV and other STDs.
I'm looking at some information I downloaded from the CDC, and I'm looking at who should be tested, and this is, comes from the National HIV Testing Day. It's trying to help people understand why they should be tested. And here's one I think that probably fits a significant number of people. It says, if you've ever had sex with someone whose history of sex partners and or drug use is unknown to you, and I guess I would argue it's always unknown to you.
It is.
Then you probably ought to be tested yearly. And for some people, maybe more often than yearly, but at least yearly. Does that make sense to you guys in this business?
Yeah, I would say, you know, we want a baseline test, so that's the recommendation, to make that just a routine part of care. And then if there's ongoing risks, such as multiple partners, men who have sex with men, some people should be screened every 6 months, even every 3 months, I would say. I have some that I screen for syphilis every 3 months. But with pretty low risk, you know, it wouldn't hurt to probably get screened every 5 years or so. Just for any risk you don't know is out there, but generally once you have a baseline and there's no new partners and your partners have no partners, you're probably good to go. But you never know 100%, that's right.
We're into our last couple of minutes, and I always like to ask about misconceptions or unproven treatments. The unproven treatment questions get us into some concerns and worries about we'll never know everything for sure, but you know, I think it's worth talking about. If I ask that question, what are the most common misconceptions or unproven treatments you see people using? How would you answer that question?
Well, I hear a lot of misconceptions about HIV, and it's usually about transmission. And so I just want to clarify that unprotected sexual intercourse and sharing needles during injection drug use are the two main routes of transmission. Perinatal transmission and blood transfusions are exceedingly rare in the developed world, like Terry has mentioned. And you cannot get HIV from mosquitoes or other insects, from sharing a water fountain or a toilet with an infected individual, from sharing eating utensils or any kind of casual contact like hugging or handshakes. It's impossible to transmit HIV that way. And so I think everyone ought to know that.
Terry?
I've seen some patients try things like colloidal silver and something called miracle water and pear and a lot of different things without much success. So in my experience, medications and healthy lifestyle are the two things that really successfully treat HIV.
In your opinion, why do they try those things?
I think people are reluctant. I mean, a lot of people are reluctant to take medications. There's certainly a lot of downsides to medications, and they've been overused. But I think we have really good, solid science that is the best treatment for HIV.
Yeah, which gets back to my point. If you're going to take something that has no proven efficacy, there's no evidence, and by evidence, I mean unbiased testing,
mm-hmm.
why do it? Usually somebody's trying to make money behind those things.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I mean, we see this, and then the argument is, well, it's maybe natural. Well, you know, there's natural things that can kill you.
Right.
And medication. So at least medicine is making an effort to try to identify and to share with people what we know about the risks and benefits. And I want to keep people thinking clearly, not trying to promote things that are not necessarily true.
And medications have gotten easier to take. You know, there used to be the big drug cocktails that everybody had to take, and now people can be on one pill a day if the situation is right.
Right, and the side effects have gotten much, much less, just even over the last 5 years, I'd say. We've made huge strides in treatment.
So we've got 1 minute. Heather, sum it up. What do we want people to take away from today?
Well, the biggest thing is on testing day, which is June 27th, to go out and get tested. Don't be embarrassed. Don't be shy about it. It's important for all of us to get tested, even all of us sitting around the table and anybody who does not know their status.
Listen to the program again. Go to the CDC website about June 27th, or just put National HIV Testing Day, and you'll get a lot more information that may help convince you the importance of doing this. So thanks very much. Very much enjoyed having you around.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. My thanks to today's guests, who are Terry Bramble of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Davey Norris, and Heather Davis of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. And if you'd like to continue this conversation on HIV and AIDS, you can join KSKA on Facebook. And you can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find the links to the Line 1 archives. You can let us know your thoughts or make suggestions at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Next Monday, our topic is a little bit less serious, but still a concern. It's bedwetting in children. Our guest is pediatric urologist Dr. Laura Merriman. I'd point out that at least one in five children, mainly often boys at 5 years of age, are still having some nocturnal bedwetting, and it can last into adolescence and rarely into adulthood. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday? Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and audio engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.